And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Sarah Ochner, a descendant of Japanese-American internees during World War II. Sarah has been studying the internment experience for over 10 years. Her thesis, Relocated Classrooms, explored the educational system in the internment camps. She has guest lectured at the University of Illinois and presented at a number of locations, including over a dozen libraries in the Buddhist Temple of Chicago. Committed to multicultural literature and outreach, she is currently a librarian with the Vernon Area Public Library District in Lincolnshire, Illinois. And Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, before we begin discussing your grandparents' experiences in a relocation camp, I believe it's important to provide the backstory to the origin of the internment camps. So on February 19th, 1942, Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066. It's not the number that's important, but what it said, that essentially forced 120,000 Japanese Americans to be imprisoned without due process in various internment camps throughout the western portion of the United States. And I have to ask, why and how did this come about? What were the primary reasons for this to occur? This is just outlandish.
It absolutely is. And a lot of this had to do with wartime hysteria. A lot of folks, right after Pearl Harbor on December 7th, people were very scared. They weren't sure what was going to happen, especially now that America was jumping feet first into the Second World War, which is not something a lot of civilians had anticipated. And a lot of the fear that had really come about was really truly based on racial prejudice, unfortunately. Racial prejudice against Japanese Americans had been prevalent long before the start of World War II. There were many laws that were actually set in place where it was impossible for Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, and even Korean immigrants to apply for naturalization in the United States. So it was that ingrained in American culture, this sort of racism. It was on a cultural level and on a legislative level as well.
You know, it was striking to me going on the internet when I was doing some research and looking at a few books, the pictures that you see. Mm-hmm. And I have one up right now that I'm looking at, and it just, there's a porch, big sign on it, and it says, "Japs keep moving. This is a white man's neighborhood." It's hard to believe, but maybe not so hard, but we can get into that later. Mm-hmm. So, Pearl, you know, there was racial injustice for Japanese Americans. How many years before would you say that you, initially when they first came here to America?
Yes, I would say that too. Really, racial prejudice against Asian Americans in general had sort of started with the waves of Chinese immigrants that had come in the late 1800s. Some folks are familiar with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 that made it impossible for more Chinese Americans to really come overseas to the United States. And in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when my family came from Japan, a lot of folks were really moving from Japan to, in search just for a better life. It was sort of economically downturn in Japan at the time, and a lot of folks from the south of Japan really wanted to come to the United States to sort of better themselves. They'd heard stories of economic opportunity, and they really wanted to provide the best that they could for their families. And a lot of folks who were living on the West Coast at the time, and unfortunately, this is a rhetoric that's still around today. A lot of folks were really afraid that these new waves of immigrants would be coming and they would be taking away their jobs. They would take jobs away from Americans and really ruin the careers that they had worked so hard to build. And again, this wasn't the case. This was just, you know, several families who wanted to come over and really, really provide for their families.
Well, it's one thing having racial injustice. It's another thing, though, opening up a relocation camp in Arizona in the middle of the desert or in Idaho or wherever, and having to just go to these camps. Mm-hmm. What prompted the executive order? So there was a climate of racial injustice. Was Pearl Harbor then, like you mentioned before, was that kind of the nail in the coffin, so to speak, for this to occur?
It was. It really sort of was the spark that sort of, I suppose, culminated all of this sort of racial tension. There were several organized groups along the West Coast. There was the Japanese Exclusion League, the California Joint Immigration Committee, and the Native Sons and Daughters of the Golden West that really, really pushed, particularly after Pearl Harbor, to forcibly remove Japanese Americans from the West Coast. And unfortunately, there were also a lot of politicians and a lot of folks who were very had very powerful positions in the government who were also for this treatment as well, too. The Attorney General, Earl Warren of California, was very
much in
favor. Yeah.
I was surprised to read that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Later became a Chief Justice. So
Exactly. And
interesting.
Lieutenant General John DeWitt also had
he's kind of the bad guy in a lot of the literature I was reading.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. It seems that one of the things he's best known for is really his push for internment and for exclusion and things. And it really was this sort of outpouring of public support for this idea that really pushed the federal government to sort of create these camps.
What was the role of the media then, would you say? I mean, did they get on board with this kind of with the camps, or was it split?
There absolutely was a lot of support for the idea of internment. A lot of the newspaper articles that I read from the time, especially when I was just starting my research, really, really got me riled up too. There were a lot of folks. There were several columnists who said, and this is a racial slur I don't normally like to use, but a Jap is a Jap no matter where they come from. There was an analogy that a viper is still a viper even when they're unhatched. So there was very much this idea that even if you were born in the United States, you still held on to sort of inherently this nationalism from the country from where your family came. And that really wasn't the case for a lot of the younger generation. A couple of terms that I'll be probably using a lot during this interview are Issei and Nisei.
Yes, the generations, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the Issei describes the generation of Japanese immigrants who moved from Japan and settled in the United States. So these would be my great-grandparents. And then the Nisei would be my grandparents' generation, so the folks who were born in the United States, who were born in the United States, and really they were educated here, they grew up here. And a lot of folks had really never been to Japan at that point before Pearl Harbor.
What's the major difference then? The fact that they were born here and then they, and that's the Nisei?
Yes.
Okay, so they were born here, so then they had a certain status that the Issei did not have, I understand.
They did, yes. Yeah. So the Nisei, the folks who were born here, did have American citizenship, and the Issei, the immigrant generation, as I had mentioned before, it was impossible for them to apply for naturalization. They could, by law, not become citizens. Mm. There was actually a law that came out in 1924 that prevented folks of Chinese, Japanese, and Korean descent, as well as several other Asian nations, from ever applying for citizenship. So you can imagine, after Pearl Harbor, when rumors of the internment camps had started, there were no trials, there were no due process to inform people. So there were rumors sort of floating around that the Issei, that a lot of parents and a lot of grandparents who didn't have United States citizenship might be deported back to Japan.
Let's talk about your grandparents, Jerry and Kay. And my assumption is that that's how you got involved in the process with all this research and study. Tell me about them. Where were they living at the time? How old were they? Just a little background information.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to kind of set the stage here.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the idea of the camps, and I've been hearing stories about camp for as long as I can remember. And when I was younger, of course, a lot of the more complicated details were left out. And it's kind of funny. For the longest time, I honestly thought my grandparents were talking about, you know, a day camp, you know, something you would go away to for a few weeks and then come back, because they talked about the mess halls. They talked about the barracks that they stayed in and, you know,
playing sports or arts or whatever.
Exactly.
We can get into that later.
Oh,
but
sure.
Yeah, so how old were they at the time?
My grandmother was 9 years old when she left Salinas, California, and my grandfather was 16 years old when he left Sacramento, California. So he actually graduated high school in the internment camps, which is a really interesting experience. Something we could talk about a little later.
Yeah, yeah. So they had to vacate very abruptly, right? Okay. So give me, what exactly happened? Did you get a knock on the door or what, in terms of that, the executive order, how long did they have to get their things together, that type of, before they were sent to the relocation camp?
So just overall, as a community, it really varied how much time you had to prepare. What had happened was there would be posters of the executive order as well as civilian proclamations sort of giving folks instructions on what to do, what they could pack, that would be posted in prominently Japanese American neighborhoods. So areas of Los Angeles, areas of California and Washington where there were a lot of Japanese Americans around. They would have posters, and by then, you know, sort of by word of mouth, folks had learned about where to go, where official offices were. As soon as the posters were put out, as soon as the executive order was mandated, folks had to register at designated government offices. So places like post offices, sometimes schools, and municipal offices, too. Folks had to register their families and where they lived.
Was there a deadline? I mean, did they say, look, you've got to board the train or whatever within a certain amount of time? How did that all
take place? They were unfortunately given only a matter of weeks. Some families who got word early had about 2 weeks to prepare. And then there were some families who didn't hear until much later because they were in more rural areas who maybe only had a few days. And there was a specific deadline by the end of February, early March of 1942 that folks had to arrive at assembly centers. So there were 17 designated assembly centers sort of scattered throughout the West Coast where they would be organized before being moved on to the relocation centers.
Okay, so let's sounds horrible. I mean, I can't even imagine what your grandparents went through. When they got to the camp, what was the process then? Did they, how much stuff were you allowed to take? I'm trying to just kind of imagine walk in their shoes a little bit here for a few minutes. What actually occurred as they walked up to the gate of the camp where the guards were?
For a lot of internees,
the process, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, for a lot of internees, their first impressions of camp really made for some of their most vivid memories, sort of getting off the trains and the buses. My grandmother remembers when she rode on the train from California to post in Arizona, where she stayed for the duration of the war. When they would go through sort of heavily populated towns, the soldiers on the trains would make sure that all of the shades were drawn on each train car because the government didn't want people to know, they didn't want other civilians to know that there were literally trainloads of Japanese Americans sort of passing through their town.
Wow.
There was some information disseminated about the camps to civilians, particularly to those living on the West Coast and living in areas where the camps were going to be, just so folks would understand, well, there's going to be several thousand people living in these camps and they're going to be soldiers and armed guards. And this is why. But in general, the majority of the United States population was not aware that this was going on.
Even though there was information that the press was giving out and the declaration had been made, they had no idea the behind the scenes that was occurring.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the first impressions, they're walking through the gate. What were the first impressions for your grandparents, Jerry and Kay?
For the most part, shock. My grandmother grew up in sunny, you know, Salinas, California. And
beautiful area, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really lovely area. And they were moved to the desert, to, you know, southern Arizona, and there was nothing but
what really was the name of that camp? Just
it was a Poston Relocation Center.
Okay, the Poston. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And
so the first impressions, you were saying?
Yes.
Yeah,
so for a lot of the internees, their first impressions, like I said, made for their really most vivid memories. And a lot of folks had thought that by cooperating with the government, by demonstrating their patriotism and their civic duty, by going along with the executive order, the internees figured that they would be very well taken care of. So you can imagine their surprise when they arrived on the dusty dirt roads of the barracks. And in the case of Jerome, Arkansas, and Rower, Arkansas, where there were two relocation centers, they were simply swamplands. So a lot of the camps were just either very dry, the camps in the south were very wet, and they flooded continuously. So it definitely did not feel like home.
Well, I guess they also went to mountainous areas, or where, like in Idaho, where it was cold and barren and snowfall. Living conditions. What were the living conditions like? Kind of give a little bit of a description of what it was like when they walked into the barracks.
Yeah. Well, let's see. As far as the living quarters themselves, they were very sparse.
No privacy, I assume.
No, not at all.
Okay.
My grandmother, it's really funny. She's 82 years old, but if you were to talk to her, she would tell you that she knows exactly where she lived. She was in block 213, barrack number 4 with her family. And she was, they were basically a part of a family of eight. So she had two parents and many other siblings. And they were assigned their barrack, and it was about a 20 by 25 foot just empty room. There were no little partitions that were made. There were no cooking stoves, no running water in these barracks, and there were no bathrooms. So all of the mess halls and all of the restrooms were in these larger, you know, communal barracks and things like that. So privacy was not really something.
Let's go back to the 20 by 25 foot.
Absolutely.
So how many people might be in this small area, like a small 20 by 25? I mean, I'm trying to imagine it's just maybe as big as like somebody's outdoor deck if they have a small deck. Mm-hmm. How many people would have to live in that little space?
Well, the government tried to keep all of the family units together. Mm-hmm. The largest number of people in a single barrack that I'd come across really was maybe about 9 or 10 people or so, and that would include parents, grandparents, and all of the children.
Now,
so it was very snug.
Were there cots or anything? Or, I mean, how does that work for 9 or 10 people? Is there enough room for bunk beds, that type of thing? Or?
Yeah, so when folks would walk into the barracks, in many of the cases, there would be a small potbelly stove, maybe mm-hmm. in the center of the room or in the corner of the room, and then there would be sort of cots and beds available for folks. But the really interesting thing, there was a civilian order number 5 that instructed folks that even though they really could only take what they could carry, maybe one or two bags at most, there was still a list of items that the government required that they bring with them. And they specifically mentioned that Japanese Americans would have to bring with bed linens, but no mattresses. And the reason for that is because in many of the camps, including the camps where my grandparents were, folks would have to make their own mattresses out of canvas bags and straw. So,
oh man!
So one of the first activities my grandmother and her brothers remember doing is sort of going out into the middle of the camps and getting canvas bags and just really stuffing them with straw and then sort of sewing them up too. And there's, Norman Mineta, who later became a cabinet member under President Bush and President mm-hmm. Clinton, said that this was one of his first memories of camp too. And a few of the other internees that I had interviewed, one of them had made the joke, you know, Sarah, that really gave a new meaning to the term hitting the hay. So,
oh, God.
So that I feel like I like mentioning that because I feel
a little
like
black humor there.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
that's sort of an example
something,
of how.
Something, to grab onto. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to just do a meanwhile for a second.
Of course.
Okay, so meanwhile, they've left their home in Salinas. Mm-hmm. What were they doing again? What was their jobs?
My great-grandparents were both farm laborers, and my grandfather's
migrant
folks,
workers then? Or,
yes, they were migrant workers, and my grandfather's folks had helped run a barber shop. The really interesting thing is because the Issei, the immigrant generation, they couldn't vote, they couldn't own land, and they couldn't become citizens. So any businesses, any land or property that these families owned actually had to be in their children's names. So basically the lease to the barbershop was all in my great uncle's names because my great grandparents couldn't technically own it by law.
But now the whole family is at camp mm-hmm. or relocation camp. You know, it's a prison. It seems like this is such a euphemism. Relocation camp,
yes.
Internment camp. I mean, it had barbed wire and, you know, sentries and guards and everything else. They were prisons. Mm-hmm. And they were inmates. But what would happen to that barbershop, for example? Would that continue to thrive? I mean, it couldn't. It would just die, right? I mean, what would happen then?
Well, it was different for a lot of families, sort of depending on the resources you had. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. we're not sure what happened to the family barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, all of my grandfather remembers is they had to up and leave it. He was also 16 years old, so he wasn't as in tune to the specific finances of his family
right,
and things like that. Right. But his brothers, they also owned a diner that was close to a major train station in Sacramento as well, and he's not really sure what happened to that either. There was this tremendous financial and property loss to the Japanese-American community. In my research, I came across one woman in Southern California who was forced to sell her 26-room hotel for $500.
Oh, geez.
So it's heartbreaking. A lot of folks, they had to sell their property at just absolutely cut-rate prices or just sort of abandon them in hopes that they could return to them after the war. And there were some folks who had friends, who had church organizations who would sort of take care of farms or houses.
But that's...
During the war.
You know, that's minimal.
It's a very select few
And quite contrary, a business can't thrive unless you're there, so... Mm-hmm. Just want to talk a little bit about, we talked about living conditions and Let's get into a little bit of this, though. You said they shared bathrooms?
They did, yes.
Okay. Privacy had to be an issue, I would think.
It was. The bathroom situation was truly an embarrassing one for a lot of folks, particularly some of the senior citizens who were in camp, too, because when you walked in, you essentially had several rows of toilets and you had shower stalls, but there were no enclosures. There were no walls to separate any of them. So a lot of internees took it upon themselves to take fabric, to take the bed sheets that they had brought with them, and sort of make their own privacy curtains just for the sake, again, of privacy and things. And that was an initiative that they had to do themselves.
In terms of food, surviving, you just kind of smiled a little bit at that question. What happened there with meals and food and things like that?
So there were communal mess halls, again, because very, very few of the barracks actually had cooking stoves in them. And your meals were served to you on very strict shifts. So each family was given a different shift because there were so many people living in the internment camps. It was impossible to have everybody share a meal all at once. To the mess halls simply weren't big enough. My grandmother remembers that their shifts were breakfast was at 7 a.m., lunch was at noon, and dinner was at 6 p.m. And you would have to wait outside in line. Sometimes my grandmother said for upwards of a half an hour just to wait to be able to get into the mess hall, because in order for you to get in, you would have to wait for families to finish with their supper and leave. And the reason that I smiled a little bit is because the meals served in camp were so very different from what a lot of children had grown up eating at home, too.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. What were some of the differences?
So a lot of the food that was served in camp were sort of cast off from Army surplus, things like kidneys, Spam. My grandmother was introduced to Spam.
Good old Spam.
In the camps. Oh, yeah. So actually, that was a food that a lot of internees sort of took with them after the camps, too. There's a little dish called Spam Musubi, which is essentially like sushi, but you have a piece of fried Spam on top, too.
Interesting. So, I'll have to try that sometime.
It's actually quite delicious, yeah. So a lot of things that my grandmother had never really tried before was sort of afforded to her in the camps, too. I believe it was Heart Mountain that had allotted 45 cents a day per internee for food. And even during wartime, that really wasn't all that much.
45 cents. So was there a canteen or of some sort that they could go to and purchase a candy bar or something as
there
well?
Was. And the 45 cents was what the government had allotted as a budget per internee per camp. There was a camp, excuse me. There was a canteen.
Well, maybe I should back up a little
bit.
Maybe I'm assuming, and I probably shouldn't have any assumptions here, that it's kind of like a, this is a horrible analogy, but like a college cafeteria where you would go and the food would be there where you would have it served to you. Or let's just call it like a prison, three squares a day. How much was it? 45?
It's about 45 cents.
That 45 cents, though, wasn't used to provide them nutrition for one day then. I mean, over the 45 cents.
Yeah, so the 45 cents was what the government had allotted. It was basically
That wasn't extra for other things.
No, not at all. So as far as if they wanted to purchase other things on their own, there were employment opportunities in the camps, and we could talk about that a little bit later and, again, focus more on the food. But my grandmother particularly remembers that rice wasn't served in camp at first. Hmm. And at least for the Japanese American community, that would be akin to taking a staple out of your diet, like bread or like potatoes. And a lot of folks were not terribly happy about it. One of the gentlemen that I had interviewed for my thesis had said, you know, if there's one thing you can't take away from us Japanese, it's our rice. So folks petitioned the government, and eventually it was introduced into camp mess hall menus. But it wasn't always prepared terribly well. Sometimes it would be served raw. Sometimes it would be served undercooked or even burnt. Another gentleman that I had spoken to said a particularly memorable dessert that he had been served was a scoop of kind of extra toasted, slightly burnt rice with a scoop of canned peaches on top.
Jeez.
So the government clearly wasn't really attuned to the wants or the needs or the culture of the people that they were incarcerating at the time.
Do you mind if I just come back to the 45 cents thing?
Of course.
So each internee would receive 45 cents. That was each day?
No, so
I'm really confused about that.
Oh no, that's okay. I apologize about that.
No. I'm just the food was provided. Then did they use that as currency to get the food?
No, okay. So the 45 cents was what the United States government would give to, and the 45 cents in particular was for the Heart Mountain Relocation Center. That was essentially the budget that they were allowed per day, per internee. So the Heart Mountain Relocation Center was given this large sort of sum of money to provide food for internees. But again, the way that the budget was broken down, the way that the government was able to determine how much money should be given to the food budget would be, okay, so we'll say each internee will eat approximately 45 cents worth of food
per
day.
Okay, all right. So that's essentially what it was worth, the meals they were getting.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay. Let's talk about jobs a little bit. So what kind of jobs would they have? What would they do within the relocation camp?
Mm-hmm. So it was very important to the government that the camps be as self-sufficient as possible. So a lot of the work around camps meant things like farm laborers. Every single camp owned and operated their own farm where they would grow their own food, and then they would also trade food between the camps too. There were also lots of professional positions that were available to internees as well. There were hospitals in the camps, and folks who were doctors or who were nurses outside of the camp were definitely employed within the camp hospitals and things. But unfortunately, a lot of the facilities, a lot of the schools, the hospitals, even a lot of the barracks themselves had yet to be constructed when internees began arriving. So,
oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So my great-grandfather on my grandmother's side had a little bit of experience with carpentry, so he was eventually hired to essentially finish up the barracks that he and his family members would be sleeping in. And that was the case for a lot of the camps.
So the job is to basically build your home.
Exactly.
Essentially, yeah. So meanwhile, there were jobs, it sounds like, and for the adults, the children then were going to school, so to speak. What was the educational system like in the relocation camps?
To say that they were ill-prepared would be a very kind thing to say. And by they, I mean the government. What's really interesting is that the schools, there was no school system in place. There was never meant to be any sort of educational system or any sort of classrooms for the internees at all. But once the government sort of ran through the numbers and they realized that there would be 31,000 school-aged children with this abundance of free time on their hands, they very, very quickly set to work a very rudimentary, a very basic sort of education system for these children.
What was the curriculum? It's dry in here, I know.
Oh, that's okay. I'm sorry about that.
No, I have the same thing. So the curriculum, what were some of the courses they were taking?
Well, the curriculum was very, very basic. It was meant to keep students occupied, and it was meant to teach them about American customs, which is an ironic thing because all of these children had grown up going to American schools, going to American sporting events and dances. So they were already well-educated about American customs because they themselves were American. The interesting thing about the curriculum is that it was designed by a graduate course at Stanford University. So there was a curriculum and instruction course that was offered there. And I want to say less than 50 graduate students were in this course. And they visited the camps before any of the internees had arrived. So this was in the summertime. And they had sort of looked at the plans of what the camps would look like. They had looked at maybe about how many kids might be attending, things like that. And they just set up without meeting with any of the Japanese Americans, without meeting with any of the children or their previous teachers to see what their experiences were. They'd sort of set up this curriculum without any other sort of aid and things like that.
And so the curriculum consisted of
some really interesting.
You just smiled
things.
When I said that. Yeah,
yeah, I had
probably not the 3 R's. I'm guessing
not necessarily. No, I've been very lucky, and I've been able to go to the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles, where I was able to look at some of the lesson plans that were actually distributed among the camps. Some of the home economics classes lesson plans were really interesting. They would have lessons on American table manners. You know, this is a fork. This is how you use it. This is a knife. And this is how you use it. Things like how to dress properly, how to get on a bus, how to eat and behave in a restaurant, things like that. And there was a language arts lesson plan that included contemporary slang.
Oh, jeez.
Which I just always thought was so
interesting. Sorry to laugh, but good Lord, you know, this is just crazy.
Well, yeah, and if you told any of my friends who are teachers right now, oh, yeah, the government really encouraged, you know, teachers to educate their students about slang, I think they would just, you know, such a deep eye roll.
So you have thousands of these kids in all these mm-hmm. camps. Who are the teachers?
The teachers, some of them were the internees themselves. Actually, I should say there were two levels of educators really within the camps. There were the folks who had the official title of teachers, and then there were folks who had the teacher's aide sort of label and everything. Japanese Americans were not allowed to hold the higher sort of ranking of teacher, and a lot of them were designated to teaching assistants. A lot of the teaching assistants included college students who just wanted to really do something with their time. They really wanted to help their community while they were in camp. Some of the teaching assistants included principals and teachers, folks who had been principals and teachers in their former lives before the internment camps. And a lot of the teachers themselves were Caucasians. They were folks who were recruited by the government, and they were either folks who were dissenters from the war, so they didn't want to go into the draft, they didn't want to fight, and instead of going out to battle, the government said, well, you can teach at these internment camps. And a lot of other teachers, too, were sort of old retired school teachers who really had sort of old-fashioned methods and were really sort of out of touch with what their students wanted or needed.
Well, particularly if the curriculum is teaching table manners mm-hmm. and how to get on a bus, too, as
yeah.
well. I tell you, this is just fascinating. I am talking to Sarah Ochner, a descendant of Japanese-American internees during World War II. When we come back, we'll talk to Sarah about the Japanese-Americans who volunteered for military during World War II and more about her grandparents' experiences in a relocation camp. You're listening to Word of Mouth. We'll be back right after this.
Then my husband died before they closed the camp.
That's the music of Mike Shimoda of Linkin Park. And pretty powerful song. That's called Kenji. And he reflects a little bit about life there, Japanese-American internment camp. And if you're just joining us, my guest today is Sarah Ochner, a descendant of Japanese-American internees during World War II. And Sarah's thesis, Relocated Classrooms, explores the educational system in the internment camps. And we've talked a lot about living conditions and educational system. We really didn't get into maybe leisure activities or the fact that they were able to provide their own recreation. And when I say they, I'm talking about your grandparents and the 120,000 other internees that had to go to these relocation camps.
Mm-hmm. So there, for the internees, there was an awful lot of free time within the camps and things like that. And even though Japanese Americans suffered such a great many hardships, there was still a glimmer of hope as folks busied themselves with different community organizations and clubs and sports teams. And what's most important to note, and I think really what's most remarkable, is that all of these organizations, they were founded, they were run, and they were financed by the Japanese Americans themselves, too. So any supplies that they needed, any tools, any uniforms for baseball teams and things, they had to order or make themselves. There's this really wonderful digital archive at the Manzanar Relocation, former site of the Manzanar Relocation Center. It's actually now been made into a national park, which is a beautiful facility. And they have this lovely
Manzanar, of course, being the an old relocation camp that
yes.
now is a memorial of sorts.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And they have, if you don't have the chance to visit the site yourself, they have a wonderful digital archive. And among some of the photographs, I think one of my favorites is actually a base that you would use in baseball. And somebody had hand-stitched this base that by themselves just so the kids would have something to use and something to play with when they went out for their sports teams.
Hmm. Wow. Music and arts, was that a possibility? Were there those types of activities in the internment camps?
Absolutely. The arts flourished in the internment camps.
And this wasn't because of the government. This is because of the internees themselves.
Again, all of the supplies and things that they needed, they really sort of pushed and found and purchased themselves. Some internees, they were able to take a little bit of money with them into the camps, but for the most part, assets were frozen. So a lot of the money that folks were able to make within the camps were from the jobs that the government had supplied to run the internment camps themselves.
We talked a little bit about those jobs in the first part of the first segment. What were they getting paid for those jobs? I mean, let's say you were a nurse in the internment hospital. What were they making?
I'm not sure how much the nurses were making in the internment hospitals, but at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center, I did see an interesting tidbit about how doctors, Japanese American doctors who had their medical licenses, who had had experience before the war and were working in the internment camps, they were afforded only about $19 a month. And that was basically the top of the pay scale.
$19 per month?
Yes, $19 a month. And that was really the top of the pay scale kind of across the board.
Regardless of what you did, that's
yes.
$19 a month.
Yes. And a really interesting fact is that Caucasian nurses who were hired by the United States government to sort of move into the camps and help staff the hospitals, they were paid $150 a month.
Hmm.
So definitely a stark contrast. So even though they earned very, very little within the camps, they really sort of pooled their resources together to sort of fund classes, to fund the creation of yearbooks and flower arranging clubs. Essentially, if you wanted to teach a class, you were guaranteed to have at least 25 to 50 people who were willing to take it. And so, of course, partially because of that, the arts absolutely flourished in the camps. And some of the artwork that we have is really some of the truest and most intimate sort of evidence that we have about these camps. There's one painting that's probably one of my favorites, not just because the composition is beautiful or the fact that it depicts Poston, Arizona, which was where my grandmother was interned, but because of what was used to make it. If you take a peek at it, and I'm sure if you were to put this into Google, you'd be able to find this. It's this really beautiful painting, but if you look about two-thirds of the way through, there's almost a really dark line. There's a crease, and that crease is there because it was painted on a box that was used for Army surplus food from the mess halls. So that truly is a testament of how internees really took what they found and made the most of it.
Used their resources, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just powerful images. Talk a little bit about the military. I found this pretty ironic. And we kind of teased this before the break as a subject to talk about. And it's pretty powerful. So now your grandparents, like Jerry and Kay, have been sent there along with the 120,000 other internees in camps all across desolate portions of Western United States of America. And now some of them wanted to volunteer for the military. And I find that interesting. I imagine there were a lot of obstacles because originally they were locked up because of afraid of spies and sabotage and things like this. And now we have people who want to volunteer who are in the camp, the Japanese Americans. What were some of those obstacles, challenges that they had to face?
Yes, and before I begin with that information, I would like to make it
yeah,
clear
sure.
as well to
yeah.
many people that even though there was fear of fifth column activity and espionage, there was not a single instance of espionage or sabotage that was found to have been committed by Japanese Americans, too. So that sort of adds insult to injury, too, when this truly was an innocent people. But
that's a very important point.
Yes.
And there was no due process. So, I mean, they were just locked up. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes,
you were talking
correct.
About the military.
So shortly after the attacks on Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans who were already in the military were actually forcibly removed. They were discharged from the forces, and they were recategorized as 4C, which means that they were now considered enemy aliens. So you can imagine that a lot of folks who, again, were in the military, they had sort of built their career around this. A lot of young men were they were heartbroken.
Well, there were some I read that had fought in World War I.
It's true. There were several.
And
vets.
Now you're a veteran of World War I.
Mm-hmm.
I'm preaching to the choir here. and you have to go to this relocation camp. It's just crazy. Anyway, go ahead. You're going to say about the volunteering for service in World War II.
Oh, sure, sure. So in January 1942, when the folks who were already in the military were sort of discharge, there were a lot of petitions that took place from folks who were no longer in the military, from folks who genuinely, truly wanted to serve. A lot of folks petitioned the government saying that they really wanted to aid the war effort in any way possible, instead of just sort of sitting within these internment camps in Hawaii, where the entire state was under martial law. They truly wanted to do something to help the war effort. And so eventually in 1943, the military did allow Japanese Americans to serve in an all Japanese American segregated combat unit called the 442nd. And what I always think is very interesting is that approximately 10,000 men from Hawaii volunteered. And again, Hawaii was under martial law. There were no internment camps there. So folks were sort of able to go about their daily lives with a few adjustments to their schedule, things like curfews, things like patrols in the streets, but nothing as harsh as being forcibly removed from your homes. So when only 1,200 volunteers, when only 1,200 men volunteered from the mainland, it's kind of understandable that the call for volunteers was met with significantly less enthusiasm. Eventually, the draft was instated to obtain more Japanese Americans from the mainland to serve in the 442nd, and upwards of 14,000 men eventually did serve in that unit.
That's so commendable. And that unit was quite the combat unit.
It was. They became best known for really fighting with uncommon distinction in Italy and in Germany and in France, where the 442nd became best known for rescuing the lost battalion in the Vosges Mountains. It really was a truly brutal campaign. They suffered a lot of casualties, but they were able to get those gentlemen from Texas out from behind enemy lines. And what I absolutely love is that they have a record that they still maintain for to this day, that they are the most decorated unit for their size and for their military service. The men of the 442nd won about 9,400 Purple Hearts. They were given 21 medals of honor.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, to put that in perspective, was it Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii?
Yes.
Lost his left arm or right arm. Go ahead. I just cut you off.
Well,
but the Purple Hearts, so over 9,000.
Yeah, 9,486 Purple Hearts, mm-hmm. 21 Medals of Honor, and 8 presidential units or unit citations.
21 Medals of Honor.
Yes.
Wow. That's. I mean, this is just an untold story. That's really, really something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually the camps closed. And January 2nd, 1945, I believe it was. What was the process then? So was that an abrupt closure? What occurred?
It really did.
And getting back to maybe your grandparents themselves.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So closing of the camps really did sort of, it was carried out in stages. So you're absolutely right. There was a proclamation that said effective January 2nd, 1945, the camps would start to close. But there were a lot of families who were still in the internment camps all the way through late 1945, early 1946. So it was it was just a very slow process to sort of get people to move and to make sure that they were settled. A lot of folks were able to actually apply for leave from the internment camps starting in 1943. Folks who were of college age, who had been taken out of college before the war in order to follow the evacuation notice, were allowed to apply for colleges in the Midwest and on the East Coast. So they could not return to the West Coast, to the specific militarized zone that included Oregon, Washington, parts of Arizona, and California as well. But they could go eastward.
Demilitarized. Okay. So they couldn't really go back. Like your grandparents were from Salinas.
Mm-hmm.
They were not allowed to go back to Salinas. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, my grandmother, it was very much encouraged within the camps by the government that they not return back to the West Coast. And a lot of families didn't necessarily want to as well, because they had just heard so many stories of racial tension. They were afraid of potential violence back on the West Coast. So a lot of families did want to move out to the Midwest and out to the East Coast. And there were a few families who did return. There were some families who had sort of given their land and their businesses into the care of some family neighbors, of church groups and things like that, and they were able to return peacefully. But unfortunately, a lot of folks who did return to California were not met with really the same kindness.
Where did your grandparents, Jerry and Kay, then ultimately reside after the camp closed?
So my grandfather and his family, they eventually resettled in Chicago, Illinois. And my grandmother, her family was able to get a job out in Seabrook, at Seabrook Farms out in New Jersey. So this gentleman, John Seabrook, what he had done was he had contacted the government and he had said, I have this farm out in New Jersey. I really would like some extra laborers and things like that. So what I can do is I can sponsor families and I can guarantee them good housing and I can guarantee them a job. And so that's part of the reason why my grandmother and her entire family sort of picked up to move to New Jersey. And this was something that a lot of businesses, a lot of farms, and a lot of communities out on the East Coast and in the Midwest decided to do. So that's really how you were able to leave the camps. You had to prove that you had a sponsor who would provide you with a job and good housing.
You know, we haven't really talked about the, we've talked about the activities, the education and all this. We didn't really get into the, maybe some of the underlying, I guess where I'm going with this is, how did this experience with your grandparents, Jerry and Kay, they went in, I mean, I don't know what their personalities were like before they went to the camp and if they changed after they left the camp. I guess what I'm talking about is how did this affect them emotionally, mentally, in the years thereafter, and if not just your grandparents, other internees, the 120,000 people. I mean, it closes, but it's not like life goes back to normal. There has to be some sort of, you know, after effect of that. And what were the after effects?
That's very, very true. What's interesting is my grandmother, she was only 9 years old when she was first put into the camps. And growing up, she was always very, very candid. She was very willing to talk about her experiences. And she attributes that to the fact that she was so young. A lot of the younger internees, the harshness of, you know, the realities of camp life were really sort of shielded from them just because they were so naive, they were so innocent. But my grandfather, who really had his formative years in the camp, about 16 to about 18, 19 years old or so, what he saw happened, sort of the juxtaposition of what he had been learning in school about democracy and the reality of being surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers, it really did not set well with him for many, many years. And he was very quiet about the internment experience, really, until I was in college and started to delve into this research more seriously. And I think that's true of a lot of internees. There are a lot of folks who still aren't really willing to talk about it. It's a part of their lives that they feel a sense of shame over, which I think is very interesting because it was not their fault at all. It was not their responsibility for having been put in these camps, but it's just not something that a lot of folks really enjoy talking about too. Just again, the immense loss that they had. And unfortunately, there are several members of the Japanese American community who were interned that I had spoken to who really felt disenfranchised. There was one gentleman who told me that he doesn't really participate in politics anymore. And his reasoning was that, you know, the government didn't listen to me then when I was a United States citizen. I was a teenager. Why would they listen to me now? And that just, it hurts my heart a little bit to hear that because it's just so important.
It's tragic. It is what it is.
At the same time, there are a lot of folks who really took their experiences in camp and they did. They made them their own. They took all the resources that they had, really sort of grew upon them, and were able to really find their own identities and really sort of forge a path for themselves. There were a lot of individuals who sort of took the experiences of camp and they truly promised to themselves that something like this should never, ever happen again. There's an activist named Yuri Kochiyama who was interned, and she actually had a very prominent role in the civil rights movement in the 60s. She worked with several different organizations, including Malcolm X, to really sort of push and say that everybody deserves equal rights. Whether you're a United States citizen or not, if you are living within this country, you deserve to be treated as a person.
You know, one thing, there were some reparations, but I guess we can talk a little bit about that just for a moment. Reagan and Carter were involved in that, where the people who were internees, there was some sort of financial monetary reparations that came about. What was that?
There was. So in the late 70s and the early 80s, the third generation of Japanese Americans, so the children of internees, they really wanted to sort of push for reparations, just for a formal apology. They had a very, very short list of requests from the United States government. One was that their parents and their family members receive reparations for being in the war, and that they also get a formal apology. So In 1980, President Jimmy Carter conducted an investigation to determine whether putting Japanese Americans into the camps was truly warranted. And of course, their findings said that they weren't. And that report was called Personal Justice Denied. It's really a fantastic report. I highly recommend anybody who's interested in the topic read it. And what had happened as a result of that report was President Carter essentially said that the internees would be receiving reparations of about $20,000 or so. And that does sound like a lot of money, but you have to take into account that many of the folks who suffered the most financially, the immigrant generation, the Issei, were no longer around, unfortunately. And a lot of these payments didn't go into effect until 1990.
Well, so that's 45 years later. I mean, mm-hmm. It's nothing, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you take into account it's 4 years of your life, it's businesses,
they lost
it's property.
Everything. Yeah.
Exactly. And in 1988, Ronald Reagan did sign the Civil Liberties Act, which did offer a formal apology to internees, which a lot of folks really sort of took to heart. So mm-hmm. that was definitely a welcome gesture.
So years later, yeah. Let's go, you know, so 70 years ago, we're looking at the fact that the relocation camps closed January 2nd, 1945. And we were discussing the racial climate regarding Japanese Americans during that era. And in what ways has the climate changed? I mean, did your grandparents feel that it changed after they left the relocation camps towards Japanese Americans?
Well, immediately afterwards, and it's very interesting, even through the 1960s and the 1970s when my mother was young, my grandparents stressed to my mother that you really shouldn't let it be known that you're Japanese American. And again, this was the case for a lot of folks, too, that it was really stressed that, you know, we don't want to cause waves in our new communities. We don't want to bring a lot of attention to ourselves. So a lot of parents instructed their third generation children that if somebody were to ask if you were Japanese, just kindly change the subject. Lie, say that you're Chinese American, that you're Korean American. And a lot of the third generation Japanese
change
Americans,
the subject.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like leaving out your culture.
A little bit, yeah. And the thing that really hurts my heart the most is that a lot of third generation Japanese Americans weren't really taught a lot of Japanese. My mother did go to Japanese school a little bit as an elementary student, but it really wasn't spoken that much in the home. It really wasn't spoken outside of the home. And part of that was stemmed from the fear of my mother, who lived in the city in Chicago, that maybe she and my aunt might be talking on a bus one day in Japanese. Somebody might hear it, somebody might not like it, and somebody might act upon it in a very unsavory sort of way. So there really was sort of this
scar,
fear.
Incredible scar.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, is I guess where I'm going with this is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about race lately. What are your impressions? I mean, have you felt like in some ways we're kind of going back to 1942 in a way? Not that we're going to have relocation camps, but as I listen to you and your story, it seems like not a lot has changed.
Well, it's really,
I don't know if you have the same impression, but that's how I kind of feel after this hour.
Well, it's very interesting that you say that, because Supreme Court Justice Scalia actually addressed a group of law students at the University of Hawaii last year, and he said that the internment camps could absolutely happen again in wartime. He said it was not justified, it was completely unconstitutional, but wartime hysteria can be so powerful that he believes that it, unchecked, it absolutely could happen again. I do believe that folks are much more open-minded to Japanese Americans, to this particular part in history. I'm coming across many, many more folks in the 10 years that I've done my research who are familiar, at least superficially, about this topic. So the fact that we're more willing to talk about this, the fact that you were kind enough to invite me onto your show to share my family story, I really do feel speaks volumes about the fact that people are aware of racial injustice and really want to take measures to sort of prevent something like this from ever happening again.
Sarah, I can't thank you enough for coming in. I know you have a few talks coming up. What's on the agenda for you in terms of talking about this topic that should be told?
I do. I have been very lucky enough to be able to present a little lecture about some of my research at local libraries throughout Northern Illinois. And my next one that's coming up is going to be at the Deerfield Public Library on February 18th at 7 p.m. And then I have another one later this month at the Grayslake Public Library on February 26th. And I'm very excited about both presentations.
Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you again so much for having me. I very much appreciate it.
Thanks again. If you wish to contact Sarah Ochner, a descendant of Japanese-American internees during World War II, and a librarian with the Vernon Area Public Library District in Vernon or in Lincolnshire, Illinois, visit her website, and here's the important information, SOKNER@VAPID.info, and hopefully you can drop by at the Deerfield Public Library and the Grayslake Public Library to hear her talk as well.
Well, and actually, email address is SOKNER@VAPLD.info.
Thank you very much for that,
Sarah.
Thanks a lot. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.